Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. I'm very happy to be back with KZYX today with a new series of programs that follow up on my past two series, Ecology and Community, and Talking About California. On these, you may remember discussions with Raj Patel, Rebecca Solnit, Alice Walker, Robin Kelly, Ignacio Chapella, Ian Bowl, and many others. This summer's series will be similar, but will perhaps cover a little more territory. I'm calling it an antinomian hour. Antinomian is an old word. It describes an old concept. I'm using the word antinomian to describe people who work against the grain, people who believe that doing the right thing is the important thing, people who feel no obligation to obey rules that they consider arbitrary or even just constraining, whatever the source. Our program will consist of a series of in-depth interviews broadcast here on KZYX every Thursday this summer at 1 p.m. Our first guest, our guest today, is Marcus Rediker. Marcus is a writer, an historian, and an activist. He was born in Owensboro, Kentucky, the grandson of a coal miner. He was educated at Virginia Commonwealth University and the University of Pennsylvania. He's now the Distinguished Professor of Atlantic History at the University of Pittsburgh. Marcus is perhaps best known today for one of his most recent books, The Amistad Rebellion, An Atlantic Odyssey of Slavery and Freedom. But he's also written recently The Slave Ship, A Human History. It's a moving, heartbreaking, terrifying, inspiring account of the Middle Passage. Before these, he's written on subjects concerning ships and sailors and pirates. His first book was Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, Merchant Seamen, Pirates, and Anglo-American Maritime History. His latest book, published this year, is Outlaws of the Atlantic, Sailors, Pirates, and Motley Crues in the Age of the Sail. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Cal. Greetings.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, Marcus.
It's a great pleasure to be on your antinomian hour. I love the idea.
I hope so. Not too obscure. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your work on Amistad, and why you wrote about it, how you wrote, and maybe we could go then to your new project, which I think is a film on this same subject. So how about beginning there?
Sure, happily. I began to think about the Amistad case, and of course most people know it through the film Amistad by Steven Spielberg. I began to think about it as I was writing the book you mentioned in your kind introduction, The Slave Ship, Human History. And in that book, as you know, I studied the many, many rebellions that took place on board slave ships. And of course, like every other scholar who's studied the subject, I found that the resistance was tremendously impressive, but the successes were extremely few. And as I watched one rebellion after another fail, and literally watched the decks of the ship run red with the blood of those people who raised those rebellions, in the back of my mind is the Amistad case. And I start wondering, how did they do it? How did they actually make a successful rebellion? So when I finished The Slave Ship and was thinking about a new project, I went to the historical literature on the Amistad Rebellion, and there's quite a lot of it. I read it all with this question in mind, how did they actually make the rebellion? And what I discovered, Cal, is that none of the previous scholars and writers who had worked on this subject had been interested in that topic. They just hadn't really asked that question. Almost everything that's written about the Amistad will have 2 pages on the rebellion and then 200 pages on the court case. And so I thought, well, I think maybe this is worth knowing how they did it. And so the more I studied the Amistad case, I saw that there had been a really important shift in the way the story was told, that this rebellion made by this group of 53 Africans, 49 men and 4 children, off the north coast of Cuba in 1839, the rebellion itself had been pushed aside in our historical understanding in favor of a concentration on the benevolent white abolitionists who saved the poor, benighted Africans. So we get, in both the history and the film, John Quincy Adams as the hero of the story. In my view, the courtroom drama had eclipsed the drama, the much greater drama that had happened on board the slave ship. I felt like this was putting the cart in front of the horse, because without the rebellion, the successful uprising, John Quincy Adams had nobody to defend before the Supreme Court. So this raised a whole series of questions. Who were these Africans on board this ship? And it turns out it's possible to know a tremendous amount about them. I found out that they were made up of probably 9 or 10 different ethnicities, all of them from southern and eastern Sierra Leone, and that the majority of them were Mende, which is the single biggest cultural group in that region. About two-thirds of the Amistad Africans were Mende. And what I discovered, the more I studied the matter, is that the secret to their successful rebellion was the military history of Sierra Leone, and especially the Mende warrior tradition. Because all of these men had come from a region where war involving the slave trade had been intense and ongoing for many years. They all had been trained to defend their villages. And when the time came for them to try to capture this vessel, the Amistad, they were very well trained. They knew what to do. So this, I think, was the main contribution of that book, to reinstate the necessary African dimension of the story. Because if we look at it this way, then these rebels, they become, in a sense, the heroes of their own story. I wanted to put them back at the center of it, at the heart of it, and see how the whole event looks differently thereby.
So you use a method of historical study, which is, you're not the only one now, but which is still a little bit unusual, and I guess we would call it looking at history from the bottom up. Is that part mm-hmm. of what you've done here?
Cal, you and I have been involved in this history from below movement for a long time, and you yourself have made excellent contributions to it. I think this is something that grows out of the movements of the 60s and 70s, in which there was a political demand for a new kind of history that came from the civil rights movement, came from the black power movement, came from the anti-war movement, came from the labor movement, at least certain parts of it. And the idea was to really take the old history from below, history from above, and turn it on its head and see what was the experience of ordinary working people. How did they not only become part of history, how did they make it? And I think the Amistad case is a perfect example of that. These unknown people on a small vessel in the middle of nowhere took action to seize that ship. They then sailed it about 1,400 miles to the northern end of Long Island, where they were captured, taken into court, cooperated with abolitionists, won their freedom, and got the most powerful people in the world to debate the meaning of what they had done. It's an extraordinary thing. Two presidents, the Queen of Spain, the Queen of England, the British Parliament, the Supreme Court, the most powerful people in the world had to deal with the consequences of what this motley crew of Africans had done. So this is one of the things about history from below, as you know very well. It has surprising outcomes. Things that you wouldn't think would make a huge difference sometimes do, and it can be all because of that powerful history of resistance from below.
Just one question about the film. I was wondering about it. The idea that they were the mutineers were tricked into making their way up to the shores of New England. Was that accurate?
That is accurate, in fact. The rebels, when they captured the ship, they killed the captain of the ship and they killed one crew member, but they kept alive two white Cuban men who had actually been their so-called owners, one of whom had been a ship captain. So he knew about how to sail the ship, how to navigate, and they told him to sail the vessel toward the rising sun, because the rising sun had been at their backs on the middle passage as they made their way from Sierra Leone to Cuba a few weeks before. So they knew that if you sailed directly east, you would come to their homeland. The captain was very shrewd and very brave. What he did was to keep the vessel sailing eastward during the daytime, but slowly. He made sure the sails were flapping in the wind and not making great speed. But at night, he would reverse course and go back toward the Caribbean and the North American coast in an effort to stay in the busy sea lanes so that someone would capture the ship and save his life. At a certain point, it became clear that they didn't have enough provisions to make a long voyage, and so he asked them, he said, "I'll take you to a place where there is no slavery." And they said, "Well, what place is that?" And he said, "It's a place called the United States." And, of course, that was the leading slave power in the world, and his idea was to go somewhere in the United States where they would be captured. They sailed all the way up to the northern end of Long Island, Montauk, a place called Culloden Point near Montauk, saw some white hunters, went ashore to see if they could help them. And when they came ashore, their first question was not, "Can you feed us? Can you give us food? Can you give us water? We're thirsty." Their first question, spoken by the one man who could speak a little English, was, "Is this slavery country?" So they had an idea that parts of this New World were slavery country and other parts weren't. And they had made it far enough north that they actually had a chance to win their case in court. Imagine if they had gone ashore in Charleston, South Carolina. They would have been on the next vessel back to Cuba immediately and probably many of them hanged or otherwise executed for the rebellion. So it turns out that there was trickery involved, but they did manage to get far enough north so that they could find allies in the abolitionists, and they could eventually win their legal case.
I wonder if I could ask you one more question as a historian. The records that you worked with in establishing this story, is it true, as others have said, that it's sometimes not just a question of finding things that are hidden in the records of the period, but actually having to work against the official record and using the court records? Did you find that to be an issue?
You know, it's a fascinating question, because when I first started working on this Amistad case, a lot of wise people said, "Well, you're not going to find anything. We know everything we're going to know about that story, and you know, good luck to you." But being a little hard-headed, I kept at it, and what I found, Cal, is that there was a tremendous amount of useful information about who the Africans were right there in the plain light of day that other historians had never bothered to look at because they just weren't interested in that question of who these people were. They were only really interested in the legal side of the story or the abolitionist side of the story. So the first point is that there was a tremendously rich body of material already there. Now, the reasons why are actually very interesting. A jail in 1839 was a very different place from a jail today in this sense. Jails were surprisingly open institutions in that day because the jailer wanted to make money on the people who were in jail and also on anybody outside the jail, for example, family members, who wanted to come in and see them. Well, it turns out that literally thousands of people wanted to come through the New Haven jail to see and talk to the Amistad Africans. This was like a spectacle. This was a very, very big deal constant discussion in the newspapers. Ministers gave their sermons about the case. It's just the talk of the town up and down the East Coast. So the jailer charges money. He charges admission for these people who want to visit the Amistad Africans. So he made so much money it became a bit of a scandal. But what that meant was that many, many people came through the jail, spoke to the Amistad Africans through interpreters once they found them, and then they went home and wrote down what they saw. Sometimes this was in private correspondence. Sometimes it was in a note they sent to the local newspaper. I was in New Haven jail today and spoke to the Amistad Africans, and this is what I learned. So the other thing that was important to this case was to study probably more than 2,000 newspaper articles. And the richness of that source was also extremely important in helping me to get to know who these Africans were. The other point here is that most people who had studied the Amistad case had really only bothered to study it in the period when the case was in court. So they didn't really study the newspapers at other times. It turns out the most important time to be studying the newspaper, the many newspapers, was in the months leading up to the repatriation, because in November 1842, the surviving Amistad Africans, there were 35 of them left, boarded a vessel to go home to Sierra Leone. And in the newspapers in the 2 or 3 months before they left, there are a great many articles about who they were back in Africa, because their knowledge of Africa was now very important to the plans of getting them back there. So in some ways, the hegemony of the legal interpretation blinded people to a lot of very important evidence.
So one last thing, and maybe just to go back to the bigger picture, the Amistad as a challenge to the institution of slavery in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a very important challenge because it was outside of Haiti, which of course was a world-changing event, the Haitian Revolution. This was a not just a rebellion, but a successful rebellion that made tremendous waves inside the United States. In other words, the fact that these Africans were in the United States meant that there was a fierce debate about what their fate should be. And this had a tremendous impact on the abolitionist movement at the time. One part of its influence was to draw more African American people into the abolitionist movement. In other words, the Amistad case helped to integrate that movement. That was important. It also influenced the development of what has been called militant abolitionism, because it's shortly after the Amistad case that people like Henry Highland Garnett and Frederick Douglass and others begin to say that enslaved African people must play a role in their own emancipation. And this is directly inspired, I think, by the successful rebellion. And they used a famous quote from Lord Byron in making this point. This was something that was increasingly repeated after the Amistad Rebellion. Those who would be free must themselves strike the first blow. And you can chart, as I've done in the book, a direct line from the Amistad case through militant abolitionism all the way to John Brown, who in 1859 decided to strike the first blow when he tried to foment slave insurrection throughout the South from Harper's Ferry, West Virginia.
Marcus, I need to pause a moment here. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. Our program today is part of a new series, An Antinomian Hour. Our guest is the historian Marcus Redeker. We've been talking about his book, The Amistad Rebellion. Marcus, maybe this is the place to move on to the new project that you mentioned to me, and that is the work you're doing on a documentary film on I guess it's a related or directly related subject.
It is, and this has been very exciting. After I finished the book, a colleague of mine and friend named Conrad Tuchscher, who is a specialist in the history of Sierra Leone, suggested that we take this book to Sierra Leone and talk to people there about it. And I was very happy to do that. So we went to Sierra Leone in May 2013.
Marcus, this is a dumb question. Excuse me for interrupting, but just tell us where Sierra Leone is and maybe a word about it.
Okay, Sierra Leone is a country in West Africa. It's just south of Senegambia. It is a country that had a significant part to play in the Atlantic slave trade. It was originally founded, in terms of its European colonial status, by the British as an anti-slavery settlement. They built a colonial capital there in Freetown. And that certainly had a major impact in terms of turning against the slave trade. The British had abolished slavery in 1807, but the slave trade continued to go on in Sierra Leone, actually not far at all from Freetown. And that is what happened in the people involved in the Amistad. They had been shipped out of a slave trading factory called Lomboko in 1839. So Sierra Leone is the source of probably a quarter million slaves from the mid-18th century to the mid-19th century.
No, thanks, and sorry. Let's get back to your project.
Okay, so we went to Sierra Leone with two objectives. One, because of this research I had been able to do to find out who these people were, who the Amistad Africans were, I knew which villages in southern and eastern Sierra Leone people had come from. So we decided that we would go to those villages and gather together the elders and see if there's any local memory of the case. And we did this, of course, with the help of an extraordinary man, a linguistics professor at Foribe College named Tazif Karoma, who was our translator and guide and someone very well known in the villages that we were going to because he actually came from that region. So we wanted to talk to the elders. We wanted to see what, if anything, was remembered about the Amistad case. And we also wanted to try to find that slave trading factory called Lomboko. People, scholars at least, had been looking for it for 40 or 50 years. And what we had read and understood was that it had all been washed away. It didn't exist anymore. It was underwater. But we wanted to try to find it. So off we went in, as I said, May 2013. It was three historians, a linguist, and a camera crew to chronicle this trip. We got there. We did a number of interviews and in Freetown and then took off to the countryside. And the documentary film, which is now nearing completion, shows exactly what we learned in the process. We did eventually find a surviving part of the Lomboko slave trading complex. And the way we found it was very interesting. We were down in the southern part, the far southern part of Sierra Leone called the Galenas Coast. And, of course, we have 19th century maps, and we knew that Lomboko was near the villages we were visiting. But we kept asking people about it, and nobody seemed to know where it was, and they told us you can't find it, and don't waste your time. And just as we were leaving the area and feeling quite discouraged, Tazif, our interpreter, asked our driver to pull over in a small market town called Funyon, and he went from market stall to market stall asking, does anyone here know anything about a place called Lomboko? Did your grandfather or grandmother or anybody ever mention this place? And finally a man stepped forward and says, I've heard of it. He said, I don't know where it is, but I know who will know where it is. said, there's a little fishing village about 7 miles down the coast. He said, I'll go with you. He jumped in the car with us, and off we went to this little village called Toko. And when we got there, we met with an elder there, a man named Vandy Massaquoi, and Tazif asks him in Mende, he said, do you know this place called Lomboko? And the man says, yes. He says, do you know where it is? He said, yes, I know where it is. My sons are fishermen on the Karefe River, and they've seen the ruins of the old buildings on this island. And then we said, can you take us there? And he said, let's go. So we went went down a probably a two-mile bush path to the river, where we got into the old dugout canoes that the fishermen used, and we then went into a mangrove swamp. It took us about an hour. This is a crocodile-infested mangrove swamp, I might mention. And they took us there. We found it. And we found the foundations of the buildings. And it also turned out that our guide, Vandy Massaquoi, the man who lived in Toko, his family had lived in that village for several generations, and he had an extraordinary body of knowledge about that place. And so he knew things that about the Amistad case that are not in any of the documents. But he knew a lot of things through the oral tradition that were in the documents. In other words, he had a very detailed knowledge that was completely consistent with all of the materials I had been studying for the previous 3 or 4 years. And he was really an extraordinary informant and highly credible. So part of the documentary, a big part of the documentary, is our quest to find Lomboko. And finally, in the end, we do get there. We find that place. And believe me, it feels like the end of the earth. It is the last place where the Amistad Africans stood on African soil before they were loaded onto slave ships. Fortunately, 35 of them came back, so it wasn't the last place they ever stood in Africa. But it really was this powerful, eerie set of ruins that made the whole story even more real to us.
Could you give us a taste of what the testimony sounded like of this remembrance of this history from the man you met?
Well, I'll give you some very good examples of it. He said that he went to a particular place on the island, and he said, my grandfather told me that this is the place where Pedro Blanco, who was the Spanish slave trader who owned Lomboko, this is the place he would meet with the African king named Shaka, the main slave trader on the African side. They would meet in this very place, and they would trade slaves for guns and gunpowder. And he went into great detail about the nature of this trade, describing the history of it, how King Shaka had become the leading slave trader. I mean, this was really all quite extraordinary. And he went on to say that his grandfather had told him that while the Amistad Africans were held at Lomboko, Sinke, as he's known to us, or Sengbe, which is his Mende name, the leader of the revolt on board the Amistad, had actually made a rebellion at Lomboko, that they had actually tried to fight their way out of there before ever being loaded onto a slave ship. Now, this can't be confirmed in any documentary evidence that I have, but what he said next made it even more fascinating. He said Sengbe was so powerful a leader, a man who commanded so much respect from all of the other captives, that he was segregated from the entire group by the slave traders. And that is exactly what happened by when the group was taken by the U.S. Navy. They saw that he had tremendous influence, so he was separated from the rest of the Amistad Africans as soon as they were captured. And it happened again as soon as they got to New Haven Jail. The jailer saw that this man had tremendous influence among the group, so he was separated out and put in a different part of the jail so that he could not inspire resistance. So here's an example of what Vandy Massaquoi knew that was so consistent with all of the other evidence I had already studied.
I should just remind listeners that we've been talking about the Amistad Rebellion, and Marcus Redeker, our guest, he's the author of the book, The Amistad Rebellion, An Atlantic Odyssey of Slavery and Freedom. Marcus, what about the documentary? Are we going to be able to see it? How do you see that developing?
Well, it's almost done. We've been working on it. The film is being made by an extremely talented filmmaker named Tony Buba. Tony is well known for documentaries that he has done about the history of working class Pittsburgh. In fact, he has chronicled the human costs of deindustrialization in his native Braddock, which is, as you know, an important steel town in Pittsburgh. And I had known Tony, you know, for some years. And when I decided that I wanted to try to make a documentary, I asked if he would come with me because he had he has a powerful feel for the poignancy of human experience, and I felt like we really wanted that. Fortunately, he was happy to go, and he's really making a brilliant film about it. It will probably be finished in the summer, and I think the premiere will be sometime in the fall. I think it's actually going to begin at the Three Rivers Film Festival here in Pittsburgh, but we'll enter it in other film festivals. We're just now working out distribution, but sometime in the fall there will be information about its availability.
And do you have a title or a tentative title?
The title is Ghosts of Amistad in the Footsteps of the Rebels. In other words, we spent a lot of time retracing their footsteps from their villages to the coast, to Lomboko, trying to reconstruct what that experience would have been about.
Marcus, before we shift subjects too much, maybe I should ask you something here about your magnificent but heartbreaking and terrifying book, The Slave Ship, A Human History, just so that our listeners understand why you did that and what it's about. Would you mind going there for a minute?
Sure, I'd be glad to. That book, Cal, is, that was a tough book to write, especially for anyone who wants to do history from below. It really meant living with the horrors of the Middle Passage for several years. But the origins of that book are interesting, and they go back to work that I have been doing and have been doing for many years in the worldwide struggle against the death penalty. In particular, the case of someone who I think will be known to many of your listeners, Mumia Abu-Jamal, the former Black Panther who was framed for the murder of a police officer in Philadelphia in 1981. I visited him on many occasions in SCI Green Super Maximum Prison, where he was on death row, and we talked a lot about history. Mumia is someone who really is fascinated by history, and we got to talking one day about the relationship, the historical relationship between race and terror, and the way in which so much of the experience of race in America and in other places has been an experience of terror. And of course, lynching comes to mind, but it's actually a much deeper and older, longer history. And this came up in the context of highly racialized incarceration practices, vast overrepresentation of African Americans on death row, and the way in which death row is in some ways a continuation of the terror of race and slavery for a great many people. And during one of these conversations, it hit me like a ton of bricks that I could study the origin of the relationship between race and terror, because that began on the slave ships. Race, categories of race, were actually produced on that ship. To give you an example, people of many different African ethnicities, as was the case with the Amistad people, they might be Mende, Kono, Bandi, Sharbro, are loaded onto a vessel, but at the other end of the Middle Passage, they are unloaded as members of something called the Negro race. So race itself is something that happens on board a ship. And, of course, it's created under conditions of extreme violence and terror. So I realized that I could study that, because I had been studying life at sea, as you said at the outset of the program, for, at that point, 25 years, 30 years, and I had actually already accumulated a lot of material about slave ships. So I thought, well, I can do that. But it still took me several years to make the decision to actually do it. And that was for two reasons. One was that I had to feel that I could do justice to the people who were on those slave ships. Writing about a subject like this has a tremendous moral responsibility attached to it, and I had to convince myself that I could do that. In the end, I don't think I ever did completely convince myself, but what happened was that I decided it would be better to try and to fail than to not try at all. And given the horrors that people endured on these slave ships, the least I could do was to try to accompany them and understand in human terms what they had been through. So that was one major issue. The second issue, frankly, was deciding whether I really could live with this horror for the several years that it would take. It would mean really trying to understand exactly what the material conditions of slave ships were. To give one example there, it was said in Charleston, California, excuse me, in Charleston, South Carolina, that when the wind was blowing a certain way off the ocean, you could smell a slave ship before you could see it. And this was the stench of the slave ship was one of its famous characteristics. And this is partly because of seasickness and vomiting and diarrhea and illness and epidemic, but it was also because of the extreme pungency of smell manufactured by the human body under conditions of great fear. So writing a book like this meant that you really have to take seriously what the human experience was on board the ship. So I decided to do that. I did this with the hope that it would contribute to a discussion about the abolition of the slave trade. The book was timed to appear in 2007, the 200th anniversary of abolition in Britain, and 2008 was the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade in the United States. It turns out there was a fairly robust discussion in Britain, but hardly any discussion in the United States. So that was disappointing, but I do think the book made a contribution to, helping people to understand this very dark side of our history, which we have been reluctant to face. One question that was on my mind was, in the post 9/11 world, we talked about terror every day, did we not? Has it not been on the newspaper cover just about every day?
Certainly.
Well, I wanted to ask, can we talk about the terror that was instrumental to building the United States? Can we talk about the terror that was at the heart of the slave trade, that was at the heart of slavery? Can we talk about that? Can we talk about the relationship between that and the creation of wealth, which made the United States such a powerful country? So that's the way I got into that book. It was basically through activism against the death penalty.
This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. Today we're talking with the historian Marcus Rediger, and we've just been talking about his book, The Slave Ship, A Human History. Marcus, thank you, but maybe we should go back a little bit and tell us something about your own history as a historian. Your first book, or the first book that I know of, is a book about pirates. How did you, as a young historian, get interested in a subject like that, and how did you go about developing it?
Well, Cal, I'm very happy to be able to tell you that you were one of the reasons why I got interested in that kind of work. Because when I went off to graduate school in 1976, a book had recently been published called Albion's Fatal Tree, edited by yourself, E.P. Thompson, Peter Linebaugh, Doug Hay, and a number of other scholars in working at Warwick University. And the key to that book was really the use of legal records to reconstruct lost histories from below. And I had been very impressed with that work. Having come out of the movements, I wanted to do history from below. And so I started asking myself what kinds of documents might I find that would allow me to do that sort of history. And I decided, for a set of, I guess, sort of quirky reasons, that I would look at pirates, because they created tremendous documentation. Every time the group was captured, there were show trials and hangings, and the pirates captured the popular imagination. So I studied pirates, trying to figure out really the same things that I wanted to know about the Amistad Africans. Who were these people? Where had they come from? Why were they doing the things they were doing? And what I discovered was that pirates were simply poor, beaten, exploited deep sea sailors who decided they weren't going to take it anymore. They captured their own ships. They set them up as pirate ships. They organized them in a democratic idiom. They divided their loot equally. They limited the ferocious power of the merchant ship captain, and really provided a different model for how to run a ship altogether. And moreover, the crews were multi-ethnic and multi-racial in the extreme. There were huge numbers of Africans and African-Americans on board these pirate ships, because what mattered was not your race, but your willingness to fight. And so I wrote an article, I guess the first thing I ever published, 1981, about the social world of pirates in the early 18th century. But then, having done that, I had an interesting dilemma, because what I realized was that I didn't fully understand the working world that these pirates had come from. So my first book was called Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea, which you mentioned. That's a study of deep sea sailors in the early 18th century, and really all about the work, their experience, again, the beatings by the captains, the poor quality food, the low wages, the very things that drove a portion of those sailors into piracy. Now, in the process of doing that, I also discovered that sailors, who were absolutely crucial to the rise of capitalism, because they linked the different parts of the world, the different continents of the world, sailors had not really been given much of a place in labor history. So I was very interested in the labor history of seafaring people. That's an interest you and I share. And was very eager to argue that sailors were very important to the history of the working class. For example, in that book I talked about the origin of the term to strike. Most people have no idea, Cal, that that's a seafaring term, and that it originated in London in 1768 when, in the middle of a wage dispute, a group of sailors went around from ship to ship and struck the sails of the vessel. They took down the sails of one ship after another. That's the origin of the term to strike. In that situation, the ships didn't sail. Commerce in London, probably the biggest port city in the world at that point, came to a screeching halt. Capital did not accumulate, and workers had a new kind of power. So that work on pirates actually led me to the work of seafaring proletarians, because these were wage workers. They were one of the biggest groups of wage laborers to be found in the world economy at this point in time. And my argument was that they were on the cutting edge of new relations between capital and labor, which will then become dominant as we move toward the Industrial Revolution.
I guess moving to the bigger picture, your work on sailors and pirates is also connected to, if you'll excuse me for repeating it, your position as a distinguished professor, but a distinguished professor of Atlantic history. Maybe you could try to tie some of these issues together. What is Atlantic history? Why is that a particular category?
Atlantic history is something that is both very old and very new. It's actually a fairly hot subject right now among historians, because we've made a very interesting turn in recent years. There's been increasing dissatisfaction with the old national histories, and there's been a new emphasis placed on transnational history, or history beyond the boundaries of the nation state. And I actually got into this somewhat accidentally, just by choosing to study sailors and then simply in following them everywhere they went. I studied sailors in England and America, the American colonies, and they went all around the world. They went to the Mediterranean, they went to the coast of West Africa, they went to the East Indies, they went to the West Indies, they went up and down the American coast. So their lives, which crossed borders, led me to see the Atlantic as the frame of interpretation that most mattered in who they were and what their laboring activities were all about. And it just so happened that lots of other people were discovering similar things. C.L.R. James once said that the sign of a good idea is that lots of people get it more or less independently all at once. And so really beginning in the 80s and 90s, Atlantic history became a very important new area of study, linking Western Europe, especially the maritime states, that would be Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands, France, and Britain, linking that to West Africa, to North and South America, and the Caribbean. That formed a system, an economic system, which is really the very origins of capitalism, based on long-distance trade and production of various kinds. And increasingly, people wanted to study that Atlantic system. Now, in doing so, people tended to forget that a group of mostly West Indian scholars, and here I mean C.L.R. James, other people like Eric Williams, and of a slightly later generation, Walter Rodney, had already been studying these Atlantic connections. James' book on the Haitian Revolution, called Black Jacobins, was an Atlantic history written in 1938. Eric Williams in the 40s wrote Capitalism and Slavery, linking the slave trade and plantation society in the New World to the industrialization of Great Britain. So in a real sense, I reached back to that kind of work in writing Atlantic history. And then, of course, I worked with our mutual friend Peter Linebaugh in writing a book called The Many-Headed Hydra, which was all about the connections among different kinds of resistance around the Atlantic, in the 17th and 18th centuries. So Atlantic history has emerged in recent years as a way of thinking differently about historical narrative.
Well, one thing, maybe you could just walk us through it in a little bit of detail in the time that we've got left. Origins of capitalism, big things like that. How do you actually talk about, you mentioned the word production, I mean, I don't know, coal mines in the West Indies, coal mines in Britain and the United States or West Africa. What do you think the connections are?
Well, this is something that Peter and I wrote about at length in The Many-Headed Hydra, and we came to that study wanting to know what happened in the aftermath of the English Revolution of the mid-17th century. In other words, there was a tremendous upheaval there, but the king was eventually restored in 1660, and at that very moment, England moved into the creation of its Atlantic colonial system. Navigation acts, the foundation of Jamaica, Barbados became a very important slave society. So we saw English capitalists moving out into the Atlantic after the restoration of monarchy and really building a new complex at the heart of which was the plantation as a revolutionary new form of economic organization. This, of course, was not only English. There were French plantations and Spanish plantations and Portuguese plantations and Dutch plantations, so it's a West European thing. But what we emphasized was the way in which the plantation system was so closely linked to the rise of the global capitalist economy. In other words, sugar was one of the main commodities associated with the rise of capitalism. In fact, people can't really understand Bob Marley's music without attending to that history in Jamaica, which was the quintessential sugar and slave society. Anyway, this had tremendous implications for the development of European economies. The capital accumulated in West Indian slavery was mind-boggling. James said it was the greatest planned accumulation of capital ever seen in human history up to that time. And so the plantation systems and the ships involved in literally creating the world market became principal dynamic elements of economic growth. The building of these European empires depended on ships, depended on the labor of sailors. The building of the plantation system depended on the labor of first indentured servants and then African slaves. And in the process of building all this, something new was emerging around the world. The world market is part of it, but capitalist production for the world market is probably a better way to describe it. So we see, Peter and I in particular, saw these developments as crucial to European history. It's something that many who write European history don't really like to acknowledge, but increasingly, I think it is accepted that these European empires were crucial to the economic growth that propelled Europe into a position of power by the middle of the 18th century.
So that's the many-headed hydra, right? That's the,
right.
And your newest is Outlaws of the Atlantic, Sailors, Pirates, and Motley Crues in the Age of the Sail. What should we look forward to in that?
That is a collection of essays, which includes work on a variety of Atlantic outlaws. And it begins actually with a question about the role that sailors played in the dissemination of knowledge and information around the Atlantic and actually around the world in the early modern era. There's the opening chapter there is called The Sailor's Yarn, because we have to remember that in the period before commercial newspapers and other forms of communication, the main way that global knowledge circulated was through seafaring people and the stories they told about the places where they had been. So I tried to draw on many years of archival research to show how that worked, how it was that sailors became such important strategically placed figures in not only the economy, but in the development of literature, in the development of philosophy, in the development of politics. And I think that it does show that sailors were not marginal to anything, that in fact they played a very important role in a great many big historical processes. But the collection of essays as a whole is really all about outlaws and people who operated beyond the law, people who took their courage into one hand and dared to resist. So slave ship revolts are part of it, mutinies on naval ships, that's another part of it. So there are essays that address different kinds of outlaw uprisings and how those have helped to shape the modern world.
Right. And one last thing. I know you're interested in adult education and working class education, and I've found myself, to my great disappointment and chagrin, that much of what happened in my own youth in the 1960s and 70s, and in particular, and in places like Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Youngstown, is kind of disappearing into at least the popular consciousness. What kind of tasks do you see that historians could take up to meet that kind of a problem?
Well, I think that's probably the biggest problem we face. I think it's something that has been addressed but continues to need attention. We still need a new historical narrative of this country, and one that takes into account the, you know, the vast majority, the 99%, if you will, who built it. And as you know well, there have been a lot of projects that, in fact, have tried to address this. There's been a lot of very good history from below. But a lot of the school curriculum remains the old-fashioned history from above, remains a very conservative celebration of patriotic values, and actually distorts the huge and complex history that we actually have. So I think there's always a struggle going on about what will be remembered and by whom. And I always think of the famous lines by Bertolt Brecht, who built the Seven Gates of Thebes? The books are filled with the names of kings. But was it kings who hauled the craggy blocks of stone? Well, of course it wasn't. And it wasn't the robber barons who built the American economy in the 19th century either. It was ordinary working people. Now, what you say about, you know, the history that we've lived through, this too has been subject to distortion and deliberate forgetting. We hear now that school boards in places like Texas now will not allow the history of the civil rights movement to be taught as part of the formal curriculum. So it's a battle. It's a struggle. And this is always an important thing for historians and citizens to be involved in. You know, what kind of history will serve us as we face the complexities of the future? This was a major reason why I wrote The Slave Ship. I think that we're not going to get very far in this country until we own up to this brutal and violent history that we have. That's who we are. We can pretend that we're not that history, but in fact, that is what has shaped us. That's what formed us. And a tremendous amount of energy, Cal, as you know, is put into denying all that history. We've got to bring it back. We've got to try to tell the truth.
Marcus, I'm going to have to call an end to this now. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure, very informative. Listeners, we've been talking to the historian Marcus Redeker, the author of many books. We'll be back next week with a new show. Thank you also for listening. At this time next week, our guest will be Barbara Garson, whose latest book is down the up escalator, how the 99% live in the Great Recession. Marcus, if you're still there, thank you very much. And listeners, good afternoon.
Thanks, Cal.